Last time we caught up with our next guest, Ben Elton, the Harry and Meghan royal split was yet to occur. But did he forecast troubled waters ahead?
Here we have the first mixed race royal. Maybe. I'm certain that Harry and Meghan didn't do it for that reason, but that's the result. He fell in love with somebody who was, oh, I wouldn't mind their job living in luxury. Didn't you imagine the pressure of being picked on day in, day out, and then you're nice for a few days and then start picking on them?
He also revealed some exciting plans for 2020.
Stand up. Now you're going to do it.
Back on the road. Yeah. First time in 15
years. Oh, come on! Yeah. Permission to shout bravo in an annoyingly loud manner.
And off the back of a huge 75-day tour of the UK last year, Ben Elton Live hits Australia touring the country this April and May.
So I went to the doctors, right? Said, lie on your side, I'm going to check your prostate. Up he goes, he's got his finger all the way up my bum. He says, so do you think there'll be another series of the Blackadder then? It's frankly not a conversation I ever want to have, even with a taxi driver, but not with a man with his finger up your eye.
Please welcome back to the show, Ben Elton.
On that note, Ben.
Show's written. Show is written.
On that note. Gosh, yeah, that was material from 205. Innocent days.
And yet
talk
relevant.
About my prostate. Yes, as I get older, all the more. I mean, I'm rarely without a digital penetration these days. I miss it when it's not there.
Probably enjoy it more than this interview.
I am guessing.
Thank you for swinging by.
You've
just winged your way in. Thank you. You've always been very kind to us.
Said I just winged my way in. I thought,
Another bomb basher.
We're going from England, where I understand it. You've got a show that's open on the West End, and you are getting 5-star reviews.
It is honestly, it's
the
huge.
Board.
Toast to Shaftesbury Avenue for once.
Are
you part
What's
of the establishment
wrong?
Now?
I know.
He used to be the.
They've decided to let me get away with it for once.
Ben, it's a huge deal to have a show. I was in London at Christmas time. I went and saw Dear Evan Hansen. Around there, it is so busy. It's such a big deal to get there. How do you? I mean,
I didn't know you were in town. You should have let me wine and dine you, Jane. You have my email.
I'm
you
sorry.
Should have. I'd have been very happy to buy you a pint in the Soho House, London.
I would have fancied that. Trust me. But it was an amazing area to be. Every night it's packed.
London's westiest West End.
Well, it is.
The heart of London.
In Soho, around there, it's very difficult
very
to get
exciting.
A show.
What's
very
the show? Talk us through.
Getting a play onto in the West End is obviously it's a dream I had when I was young, and I've had a few, but not for a long time. And I've got a new comedy play. It's not a musical. It's a comedy, and it's about Shakespeare. It's based on a sitcom that I wrote for David Mitchell, the great British comic from The Peep Show and Would I Lie to You? And it's about him as a sort of irascible, endlessly put upon William Shakespeare. Quite a sort of literary piece. I mean, there's a lot of real Shakespeare in it. And of course, its natural home is the stage, and it's had amazing reviews and is selling shed loads of tickets. So I'm feeling very, very happy. Yeah.
Is that a big, I mean, I'm not joking. I say it must be a relief because it's very, financially, it costs a lot to put shows on. Mm. Did they have to do it off Broadway first? You know, technically not Broadway, but the UK version of off Broadway.
The day's really been able to warm up anywhere. It's a very, very expensive exercise to do something out of town. If you can get into one of the subsidised houses in one of the big cities, you know, sort of Coventry or Liverpool or Birmingham, that's a great thing. If you can do a deal with a local house. This went straight into the West End. Obviously, I don't invest in stuff. I'm a writer. I'm happy to make money, but I do it through my art. I've never been an investor. But this show was attractive. I mean, I'm not going to deny it's based on a hit TV series, so that's a big help. The big thing was, will people, when you've got something that people have got a big expectation of, a lot of fans, that's a different type of pressure. And obviously, enormous amount of work. I worked very hard on a script, many, many drafts, many, many long, lonely nights, and a lot of work rehearsing it up. I didn't direct, but I got a great director in to do it. And we got the result. But yeah, it is a very nerve-wracking thing, and you never lose the excitement, but you also never lose the nerves. And had it gone wrong, it would have been devastating. It always is, you know. Getting a proper slag in, and I've had a few, can really
hurt. Both of you,
welcome to my world. But you're a writer, first and foremost, isn't it? That's how you got out of the ground. And,
everything starts with a written word for me.
Must give you so much joy to finally reap the rewards on the West End. Toast to the West End. I can't believe it.
Yeah, amazing.
Pardon me, Your Majesty.
Well, so you're also very, what I love too, because you've collaborated with Queen, and we've been talking about Queen because they've been here. I saw the Firefight concert. And,
I had dinner with them the other night.
I'm so jealous because I'm so mad on
And Roger Page.
I'm mad on them all, but they were so smart because originally you, of course, did a stage show with Queen.
Yeah, we were rocking.
And they were smart to ask you as a writer, instead of going the Andrew Lloyd, you know, down that road.
Mind you, he asked me to.
Oh, did he?
I did a musical with him. Well, very serious one, actually.
But what I mean is that I thought that was very clever of them to ask you.
Well,
as a comic writer,
I'd like to say, it was wonderful. Obviously, one of the great opportunities of my life. I love rock and pop and Queen's music is a unique community music. I love a community laughing together, clapping together. You know, I like it when people are enjoying something together. I don't like it when they're scratching their heads and going, I think this might be funny. I'll write to The Guardian and say, am I allowed to laugh? When they approached me, they made that very point. They said, look, we've never taken ourselves seriously. Freddie always liked to laugh at himself. And we want our show, if we can get something together, we want it to be a comedy and we love your work.
Great.
So they invite me in and a very long and very lovely friendship. I mean, maybe some of your listeners who are gnarly old cynics go, dropping names or whatever. But we actually became very good friends and have remained so over all these years, 20 years of close friendship. And even though We Will Rock You is beginning to, you know, is winding down and they've had this incredible thing with their movie, you know, it was great. I was able to have dinner with them and saw their incredible gig.
And Adam Lambert is an amazing
They
voice.
Know how to choose their collaborators.
They do.
Yeah. First me, and then Adam.
Hey,
I'm a better singer.
Enough of this top end of town stuff. It doesn't interest me. I'm more interested in this live stand-up tour. Let's take a break, come back, and drill down on this. This is the most exciting thing I've heard in a long time.
Drill down on me anytime you like. Ben Check Elton's my prostate while you're there.
This is Kennedy Malloy. This is Kennedy Malloy. Ben Elton with us in studio. Ben Elton Live 2020 is touring the country from April. LiveNation.com.au for all the information on tickets, beginning in Perth at the Concert Hall on April 20.
Do not die wondering. Get along and have a look. I had the pleasure of seeing you many, many years ago downstairs at the Comedy Club in Melbourne at the Hilton. I think it was the Motormouth Tour.
Yes.
And you were bang on. It was just one of those rare experiences of live comedy where you walk away going, I'm stunned.
And also aspirational, I guess, for a generation of comics, stand-up comics in Australia in particular.
Brilliant. So there's no doubt that what happened to stand-up comedy in the 80s, and I was lucky, I was born at a good time, you know, it was divisive times, and comedy changed radically from being just a medium for jokes, which is great when it's funny, but to a medium for ideas. Mm. And for me, it remains so after 40 years. I'm still basically doing the same job.
And was it a big step for you, as we said, where you were primarily a writer and you wrote for some of the great English comedians of all time, and then to go, you know what, I'm going to get up here. I'm going to do my own stuff.
That was right at the beginning. I mean, within weeks of Rick and I starting to talk about the young ones, the late, great Rick Mayall, I became a comedian. I never intended to be one. I needed to make a living, and I needed people to look at what I had to offer. I was sending my plays. I thought I was going to be a playwright. Turns out I did in the end, but it took a long, circuitous route. So now I started my first gig in 1981. I was 21 when I did my first gig, and I discovered that I loved the art form. I didn't like the fear.
It's very risky. That's what I'm about to say. You didn't mind that adrenaline?
I didn't like that. I used to say that the backside of a stand-up comedian ages at twice the speed of the rest of his or her body. I used to say, I'm only 21, but my bum can remember the war. So that's a 40-year-old bit of stand-up comedy. I'm still.
But we were talking about the reviews for your stage show, and the thing about stand-up comedy is you don't have to wait for the papers to come out to find out how you win.
Yeah.
It's pretty much it's the most brutal form of all the arts. You don't die wondering. Arrogance is probably the wrong word, but to stand in front of a room full of people without an instrument, without a backing band, and go, I'm going to make you laugh.
What's a very
is
so
an incredible
risky.
You're trying to make it. I think I'm going to cancel the gigs. He's trying to make me. Where's the loo?
I've got a really bad feeling about this, by the way.
Look, it's not just a cool. Yes, it is. It is. Obviously, it's not risky like coal mining or firefighting, but it is, you know, outside of the really brave stuff, it is a tough job.
Yeah.
But it's so rewarding because it's such a subjective art form. For me as a writer, I write novels, plays, sitcoms. They're all semi-objective in that I have to get my head into various characters and look at the world through different points of view. On stage, I'm looking at my point of view. This is me. This is my truth. Yeah. I feel this way and I'm using the passion of how I feel to energize my comedy. So in a way, that makes it even scarier because if you
it's
tell
very
a joke,
personal,
and you,
really?
Exactly, you tell a joke, you don't get a laugh. Well, that dies. But if you've actually committed your heart and soul to it, if this is you're saying this is my truth, and I'm taking the comedy this way to express that truth, and people don't understand,
then yeah, that would be, but it isn't happening. In fact, everybody's loving it. So what can I tell you?
Is it a good time to be doing stand-up? Is there so much? I mean, do you sit down and go, this is, there's just so much I need to get out. Well, there's so much I want to say right now.
May you live in interesting times. There's no doubt about it that art flourishes, all art flourishes, in times of trouble and conflict and confusion. I mean, there's no doubt, there's no surprise that the 80s produced alternative comedy, edgy comedy committed to a social kickback because
the Thatcher years.
It was a very divisive time in Britain. First gig I ever did, I could smell Brixton burning as I came out of Leicester Square Tube Station as the first race riots. I say race riots; they were basically an uprising against a police force that was racially profiling. Yeah. There's just no doubt about it. And Britain was in flames, and we then had a miners' strike. Yes, you're absolutely right. These are good days for comedy because they're difficult days for the world, and we know. The world is being led astonishingly by a group of entitled old white men motivated exclusively by venal self-interest. There's nothing one can almost say about that they don't even say themselves.
Yes.
Some people say to me, oh, I bet you ever go at Trump. He must be a really easy figure. He's impossible to satirize. Not just because he's self-satirizing, but because he is without shame. Everything you say about him, you go, yeah, I'm smart. I don't pay taxes. Yeah, I'm smart. I tell lies. Yeah. Why would I tell the truth when I can win an election? He famously said, I could say whatever I want. Right. I could shoot someone and they'd vote for me.
Yeah.
So you have to make the satire harder and more subtle, and you've got to get inside the issues. And yeah, it's challenging, but it's hugely rewarding time to be doing stand-up, particularly, you know, socially and community-motivated stand-up.
What about the PC side of things? Does that...
Oh, I deal with that a lot. Oh, people say to me, you're going on tour. Oh, you're brave. I say, what? I said, well, you can't say anything these days, can you? How can you do a two-hour routine when you can't... The one thing everybody knows, the only thing you can say is that you can't say anything. Yeah. It's rubbish. Yeah. This idea that the world is being constrained by political correctness. Political correctness is great. Political correctness is just generally people having better manners. Yeah, every now and then, people can get a bit over-pious and a bit over-censorious, but on the whole, this is a right-wing trope, the idea that radical lefties are constraining intellectual freedom. Funny, then, how Trump, Morrison and Johnson all got elected within the same couple of years. It doesn't seem to me that the left is winning any intellectual debates
at
the moment. So, no, it's a myth. I do deal with it, this whole idea of a new censorship that's coming from the left as opposed to the right. And there's elements of truth in it. I mean, I look at anti-BBC or anti-ABC, which for 50 or 60 years is the moral compass of the nation, was guided by religious reactionary sensibilities. You mustn't swear, you mustn't ever show sex, but certainly not gay sex. Now the pendulum has swung so far that the morality of anti-BBC is kind of liberated, cool, lesbian anti-BBC. Yes. Good, it's great, but it's how interesting that now it's almost the other way. Their morality is that you must be woke, you must never be reactionary or religious. It's very interesting. I have a lot of fun with it, but on the whole, I do not think language is chaining anybody down. We need to celebrate it.
Now, what about your stage show? Have you got any effects? Like, do you come out of a giant clamshell with dry eyes?
That's interesting.
Are you sitting by a fireside with a pipe,
stool?
Peter Ustinov style?
I keep my giant clamshell for the bedroom, Mick, as you know. So Sophie and I, it's very private, and frankly, we don't want anyone witnessing when I come out of a giant clamshell. No, anyway, the point is, no.
I am
a barefoot animal, as Shakespeare said. I've had one big change, Mick. I now use a Madonna mic.
Good Lord.
It's changed me. I love it.
What do you do with your hands?
I do lots of things with my hands.
Well, it's like an Apple presentation.
I love it. For many years, for the first 6 years of my career, I stood behind a microphone stand and I never took the mic off. Then went in Australia with Rick on tour with the band that my wife was bass player of all those years ago. I took the mic off and started to move around the stage. And now I've discovered the glory of hands-free.
And you can move around because you're someone I know, you move, you're sort of you don't like to sit still. Not that you're agitated, but it's sort of something that would suit you to move around.
I love it, you know, because I do mime and act out my stuff. And so that's been a change. But no, there's no massive theatrical effects, and I hope that's reflected in the price, Mick. The value added is very much in the intellectual content.
Well, I'm happy to see you're playing theatres largely.
Certainly not arenas. I couldn't fill an arena, but in a way.
But I don't think I would want to see you in an arena. I think it's much more intimate to be in a theatre.
I'm glad I don't have that temptation. It would be a very hard devil not to embrace. If somebody said, you know what, you can sell 10,000 seats, do it all in a night, get it. make all that money, whatever. That must be very, very tempting. But we all know.
But will you be happier?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I'm not arguing. People who go to those gigs, they obviously enjoy the communal experience.
Yes.
I think the reason there's been this huge explosion in arena entertainment is people want to feel part of a community. Yeah. They're sick of sitting behind their iPhones.
That's the second time you said that. That's very interesting, being part of a community. Because people, a lot of people don't go to church anymore. People don't do things. So
a physical community.
Going to music gigs, going to theatre. That's the thing people have in common.
You go together, say, we all love this comic or whatever. But nonetheless, I don't think anyone denies a different experience. And certainly with the material I do, which is complex, I talk a lot. There's six ideas going at once and they're all going to weave into and out of each other. You know, it's...
Sounds like me every day.
Yeah, exactly. I think a theatre's the right scale and that's what...
You're not going to die wondering. You're going to leave that show with a head full of ideas. We always love it when you pop by. We're always on your case to come on our show.
Yep.
Whenever you're about, we're going to keep badgering you.
Well, you know.
Anytime. Can we check in on you when you're travelling around Australia too? We'd love to just even have a chit-chat.
I would love it. But you guys are definitely going to come and have a beer after.
Oh, 100%.
You? I would really like that, seriously. Please.
Absolutely, lock it in.
Don't be like ordinaries and pay. Let me comp you up.
Hey, just on a sidebar, and I know it's not your vintage or whatever, but the passing of Terry Jones, which out here,
we
met him and we loved him. We came up through sketch comedy as a pro, and so to us, he was always had this rarefied.
Well, whenever a python dies, the fairies cry.
I was going to say in English comedy.
Well, of course, losing a python is you know, in comedy terms, it's like losing a beetle in global terms, you know. Yeah. And there's no doubt it was very sad. I was lucky. I knew him a little bit. We had dinner a couple of times. And I was fortunate to be the first guest star in the great revival. They did, you know, they did this huge live show a couple of years ago and they had a guest star each night. I did the rehearsal the last night when they were rehearsing and I did that fun. And of course, by then, Terry was, you know, beginning to go a little bit, but still full of life and still sparky, but perhaps is, you know, perhaps not as sharp intellectually as he'd been.
Yes.
And, you know, everyone has their time. He wasn't a young man, and I'm absolutely minded entirely to celebrate his life. When Rick died, we all knew that was a tragedy because he had so much more to give. You know, obviously, we all wish Terry had lived longer and enjoyed life further, but nonetheless,
indeed,
we celebrate a full and completed life, whereas with Rick, we mourned an incomplete
too
one.
Too soon. Yes. Yeah.
All right, then. I think we're done here. Thank you for swinging by. Good luck on this tour. I've got a bad feeling about it, so I hope it really works.
You guys come along. Well, they liked it in the UK. Let's hope I don't mess it up over here.
You'll be right.
I think you'll be okay.
This is Kennedy Malloy.